2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andreas Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
In today's episode of Project Recovery,
for those who won't or can't get themselves to get help themselves, I've considered what I do as one of the first steps in substance abuse treatment. If they can't make the decision on their own, I put them in front of a judge to give them opportunities. And I have had a lot of calls over the years from prosecutors saying, hey, we've got this case you sent to us, and this is what we're thinking about doing as far as a plea. You know, they get into a program or they don't do jail or they go to drug court or whatever. I am all for that.
Make sure you listen to the end. Find us on Facebook at Project Recovery. We'll have that and much more coming up. Welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, but more importantly, it's about recovery, and it's brought to you by our friends at knowyourscript.org. For information about the opioid epidemic, go there, check it out. They've got a lot of resources, and without them, we wouldn't be able to do this podcast every week. I'm KC Scott. That is Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist. We were just talking off air. If people have listened to this podcast, they might know that you don't have the ability to smell.
Right. The nose doesn't work anymore.
Anymore.
It used to. And I remember how things smell, which is a weird experience. Like, you can sit and anybody can do it. Like, think about something that's, you know, pizza or whatever. Mm-hmm. You can remember how it smells. That's me.
Yep. And do you remember the last thing you smelled?
No, because every once in a while I'll catch a real smell and it lasts for maybe a second or two and it's gone. But it was probably in my late 20s, early 30s, it really started to be noticeably a problem. And it's a degenerative olfactory problem, you know, that nerve in the top of your nose.
You know, a side effect from the COVID for a lot of people was the not smelling.
Not smelling or smelling weird things. I have friends who said that everything kind of smelled like a decaying bog, you know, like organic decay.
Death, desperation, sorrow.
So you have strawberries and they smell like, you know, dying stuff.
Well, TikTok's never steered me wrong. If you take an orange and then you burn it, and then you take a bite into it, you should be able to get your smell back.
Is that a TikTok thing?
Yeah.
Wow. What am I been wasting time with doctors for?
Well, let's get to the show and then you can go home and give it a shot.
I will.
Come back next week and tell us how it went.
That'll be my homework.
So my homework is always coming up with the first 10 minutes of each program.
Yeah.
And I'd like to say that I think about it all week.
Do you?
No, but I don't.
You'd like to say that, though.
But I would, but I don't. What I really do is I get into my car, and the 15-minute it takes me to get here, I go,
I know how you operate, Casey.
What could we talk about? And it got me thinking I'm curious to you, because there's a lot of people that have sat down on this podcast and talked about their substance abuse. Mm-hmm. And the reason they originally were drawn towards substances was it was a coping mechanism.
Yeah, that's common.
And so I think rather than battling the substance abuse, we should be able to go back and give people better coping mechanisms. And that's what they taught me when I was at Pinnacle Recovery. Mm-hmm. They taught me, you know, meditation, breathing, being in present, and a lot of that.
It's a prevention model, right? If we can prevent the things that are causing, you know, if we can treat or prevent the things that are causing you to use, and we prevent your use.
There's a lot of people who have sat down in that chair right over there and said the first time they tried marijuana or the first time they tried alcohol is because they had a lot of anxiety as a child.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden when they took it, they felt normal. So you work with kids because you're a clinical psychologist, and that's mostly who you work with is young adults.
Teens. A lot of older kids, teens, and young adults are probably the majority of the people I work with, yeah.
So what could we help the listeners at home with? How could we give them some positive coping mechanisms? How could we have them talk to their kids if they're feeling this anxiety, of something they could do to help them?
Well, that's a great question. Well, first of all, the kind of anxiety has both kind of a learned aspect, but it often starts with a biological predisposition, which runs in families. So if you're a parent, you ought to open that dialogue. You ought to say, first of all, have I experienced anxiety? Did I feel like stress was hard for me to handle? That was I anxious and really shy as a kid? Maybe you didn't think of it as anxiety, but were you hesitant to join groups? You know, that sort of thing. And then talk to your siblings, talk to your parents. Did they have similar things, similar problems? A lot of families don't like to talk about that, but it's good to talk about. Just like you ought to talk about if grandpa had heart disease or grandma had cancer, you got to talk about those things. And then know that your kids are at higher risk for that. So talk to your kids then about the fact that how do they manage stress? Do you, can you see them stressed out, and what do we do? But there are a lot of different sorts of things you can do to help with that.
Because I'm thinking to myself, because I never had those conversations with my parents or my siblings, but the coping mechanisms that I used up until this point were more of a learned behavior. I saw how my dad dealt with stress. Mm-hmm. I saw how my mom dealt with stress. And those are kind of things that
modeling. Your parents model to you, whether they realize it or not. Like how they deal with stress is how you deal. An example I always use in therapy, or I like to use, is because everyone's seen the movie A Christmas Story with Ralphie and all that, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so in that movie, the dad models a fantastic way of dealing with stress. Not down in the basement when he's cursing and swearing at the furnace, but when they get the flat tire. And dad's driving along, he gets the flat tire, and you'd think a dad would kind of lose it, you know, get upset, curse a little bit. He's really upset but he doesn't, does he?
No.
This dad, you know, the talk over in the movie is my dad thought he was in the pit at the Indy 500 changing a tire. Before he jumps out, he turns to his wife and he says, "Time me." You know, he jumps out and he's having fun with it. Mm-hmm. That's a great example of a father modeling a wonderful way to deal with a stressful situation. The tire's got to get changed. You can curse and swear about it. Or you can be, you know, happy and turn it into a kind of a fun little game. And so as a parent, you asked earlier, what can parents do? Well, one thing is check your modeling. Like, how do I model handling stress? Do I curse and swear? Do I get upset? Do I slam the table? Or do I have other more healthy ways of modeling dealing with stress? Kids tune into that.
Here, I'm not proud of this, but I remember coming out of recovery and something bad happened. And I said the F word. I said it loud.
Mm-hmm.
Audible
around
for my
kids?
The deal. Audible for my whole family to hear.
Okay.
But they weren't in the room with me.
Okay. So it was pretty loud.
And my son comes down, and so he was probably 7 at the time. And he goes, "Dad?" And I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Why F?" You know?
And he says it.
He says it. And I went, "Oh, this is not good." You know, and that's the thing is that, I mean, but that's something my dad would have done. And then I really thought about what I'm doing and what I'm saying.
How you're modeling
and I was
behavior,
like, because he didn't understand what it means, but he knew that I was mad. And I said that, and he said, "Why?" And then this is learning from a 7-year-old. I go, "I don't know why."
Yeah.
And, you know what I mean?
Doesn't have to be that. But,
no.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah. And so they are a lot smarter than we know. And I think we should reiterate that modeling behavior, because it's not what you say, it's what you do. Mostly when it comes to kids.
Especially when it comes to kids. Their radar is always up and they're always paying attention. And part of the task of being a child and a teenager is learning how to meet your own needs. That's one of the natural psychological stages of development that everybody goes through. We all have different kinds of needs, physical, emotional, psychological, interpersonal, and how do we meet those needs? Well, our parents are our first model of how we meet those needs. So, you know, when I have stress, getting rid of stress is a need. Managing my stress, how do I do it? You know, if a parent resorts to a lot of yelling and cursing, physical aggression, slamming the table, or do you see your parent turn to a drink or getting stoned? A lot of parents don't hide that from their kids, and even if they think they're hiding it, they're not really.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can model inadvertently some really unhealthy behaviors to our kids. And I would say that's one of the very most powerful things you can do is check your modeling. Try your very best. If you feel like you don't have coping skills for stress in your life, this has been a tremendously unique and stressful year for everybody in the country. And so it's a good year to say, well, how did I manage my stress during the craziness of 2020?
I can tell you right now, drinking has gone way up.
Drug abuse
has gone way up.
Right.
Domestic violence has gone way up.
And so people are falling back on some really unhealthy skills, if you want to call them that, to manage their stress. But there are a lot healthier things out there. Exercise is a wonderful thing. Learning how to speak differently. I mean, that sounds weird, but I coach people all the time on how to express themselves differently to get better outcomes. Things like mindfulness, meditation,
breathing,
journaling. There's lots of different stress skills that are very healthy, but unfortunately we often react to our emotions, and that's where the anger comes out, and then we're modeling negative things to our kids. So check your modeling as a parent. That's a healthy thing to do.
One thing that I found really helpful during my recovery is to take a moment.
Mm-hmm.
You said it right there. A lot of people are reactionary.
Yes.
And you know, they just open their mouth and whatever comes out. And mm-hmm. I'm normally like that. But sometimes if I stop, take a step back, assess the situation, and then get my thoughts and then go from there, because reactionary is huge.
A lot of people struggle with what's called low stress tolerance. They just can't, they think they can't, tolerate stress very, very, very long at all. And so they learn these quick reactive sort of behaviors to try to push stress away or stressful situations. And unfortunately, those are often very aggressive or negative. So you can check yourself when you have a stressful situation, how long can you wait before you deal with it? Obviously emergencies may be different, but you're in a stressful situation. Can you take a minute? Can you stop and breathe? Can you, the old cliche, count to 10? Can you walk away and come back and deal with it effectively? What's your stress tolerance level? You might be surprised if you really look at how you handle stress. You might realize, boy, I can't tolerate stress very well, and I've developed all these less effective, less maladaptive would be the term I'd use, ways of dealing with it. So learning to tolerate stress yourself goes a long way in your parenting.
I mean, it reminds me of my favorite philosopher.
Who's that?
Ice Cube.
Oh, Ice Cube. Okay.
He said, you got to check yourself before you wreck yourself.
Well, truer words were never spoken.
You know what I'm saying?
I do.
Hey, we've got a great show for you today on Project Recovery. You might remember about 2 weeks ago, we had a young lady from Bird's Eye. If you don't know where Bird's Eye is, Google it. Her name was Jessica Butterfield.
I kept getting it mixed up with the frozen vegetables.
Yeah, nope.
It's not that.
not that. But she came out and she talked about how she kind of got into addiction and how she battled it and was pulled over by an officer. Mm-hmm. That officer kind of changed the course of her life, and now they're actually living together. Her kids play with his grandkids.
Well, let's clarify that. Okay, but they're not living together.
Living next to each other.
Next door. They're neighbors.
Yeah.
By happenstance, she happened to move in next door to him.
Yes.
I just wanted to be clear.
Makes sense now.
Yeah, okay.
It made sense in my head.
I know it did.
It just didn't make it down to my lips.
It didn't. That's what I'm here for, buddy.
Our guest today is Sergeant Spencer Cannon. We're going to hear from him in just a second. You're listening to Project Recovery.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was 3 blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.
Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That is Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist. A lot of people ask me why I say that, and I say, well, it's in the contract. Because you went to all those years of school. We should probably give you your just dues.
I didn't put it in the contract, though. Let's be clear about that.
Clinical psychologist.
Yeah, that was put in because the people producing this show wanted it to sound credible.
When we started this show, they said, we like your idea, but can we get somebody smarter than you to validate it? And I was like, I know a guy. Let's see what he's busy.
Yeah. No, well, we've done work before and it's fun. I love doing the show, but yeah, they put it in, just to be clear. I don't care if people know.
One of the reasons I love this show is because sometimes the story comes full circle. 2 weeks ago, we had Jessica Butterfield on, and she told her story of addiction.
Oh, great story.
And what she's doing now, and, and all the good stuff. Well, one of the guys who was a key player in her story is here today. It's Sergeant Spencer Cannon. How are you, sir?
Doing well. How are you, Casey?
Good. So before we get into kind of your story and everything that goes on with Jessica and your own family, because I know you've got some recovery in your family as well, and that's going to be fascinating for people to hear kind of how that all played out. Tell me your side of the story of Jessica Butterfield.
I work for the Utah County Sheriff's Office. I've been there a little over 30 years, worked in a variety of capacities. But December 17th, 2008, I was assigned to our patrol division. I worked on a specialty team. We do traffic and drug and alcohol enforcement. And I was working a shift that that evening, I guess it was, and just driving down the freeway approaching Spanish Fork on I-15. And I'm always watching for things that might need some attention. And she made a lane change without signaling. This car did. I didn't know it was Jessica at the time. But she made a lane change without signaling. And I thought, well, I got nothing else going on right now, so I'm going to pull her over. And I pulled her over. And when I checked her name, she had a couple of arrest warrants. I did search the car. I found some tobacco in there. And she had a suspended driver's license. She wasn't able to pay for the warrants. They were like $1,500 in bail, and very few people have that to be able to do that. So I took her to jail. I try to not impound cars if I don't have to in situations like that, but she didn't have anybody who could come pick it up.
Because a lot of times that's insult to injury.
It is. Well, it really is.
And because all of a sudden, what people don't realize, and this happened when I got my DUI and they impounded my car, I mean, it's so expensive because it's
I don't know how expensive
they impound
is
your car. Yeah. That's about $1,500 for the original impound. Mm-hmm. And then if you can't pick it up that day, usually a lot of them happen on the weekend, so you can't get them out on the weekend. So then it's $50 a day. And so in order to get your car back,
that's up pretty quick.
I mean, it could be somewhere from $2,000 to $3,000.
It is. It's pricey. In this case, it was just a hold for owner impound, and so it was a little bit less, but still there was the cost of that. And then took her to jail. And I didn't know. I remember at the time I didn't know anything else was going on, but I remembered getting the sense there's something more going on here that I didn't know. After that night that I took her to jail, I really didn't think much about it. I remember going through some old reports and coming across it once 5 or 6 years ago, but that was really the only attention I gave it until a year and a half ago.
And you moved in next to her.
That's correct.
But she says, and she said on this very podcast, that she was on her way to buy heroin.
And I didn't know that either, yeah.
Had she picked up the heroin, came back, you already said you searched the car, that would have been a felony.
Right. Yeah, at the time, possession of heroin was a felony, even just user amount. And, you know, I can't just search a car because I want to. I had a reason. I had an odor of tobacco, and she wasn't old enough to possess tobacco, and so that's why I searched the car. And I probably would have done the same thing if I got her after she made the purchase of the heroin. That's at the time was a felony, and she would have gone to jail for that.
She would have had a felony had she had even just a small amount.
Very likely would have had a felony
of,
record.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm actually, as kind of a curiosity that just popped into my mind, I don't know the answer to this, and you started to explain it. What are the criteria for searching someone's car? So this person had not signaled when they made a lane change. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I've been guilty of that before, you know, and if an officer pulled you over, what are the criteria for searching through a person's car? I'm just curious.
Yeah. The criteria, you have to have probable cause to do a search, to be able to search a person or to search a car, I should say. If I have a house or a building I want to search, I've got to go get a warrant for that. I have to have probable cause for it. I have to write a statement and show that to a judge.
They have to sign off on it.
And the judge has to issue a warrant. They've made exceptions for automobiles because of the basically the evidence could go away if I don't search it, and taking the time to do that is not reasonable. So it's a plain smell or a plain view doctrine is what they call it, meaning if I smell a substance that is not legal. So if I smell alcohol in a car, I can't just search the car if there's one occupant and it's an adult and they haven't consumed enough to be arrested for driving under the influence. But if I smell alcohol and I've got everybody in the car who's underage, then that is enough probable cause to search the car based on the odor. Uh-huh. If I see an open container of alcohol in a console, doesn't matter if they're underage or not. You can't do that in Utah, and that would give me probable cause to search the car. And in this case, the probable cause was that I smelled the odor of tobacco, and she wasn't old enough to possess it, so I searched the car based on that. I think I found three cigarettes.
What you're saying is I would be a terrible police officer since I can't smell.
Yeah.
I never thought about that.
It would be a hindrance.
I would never be able to pick up on those odors.
And because I've been in the TV long enough and watched the news, I'm an avid follower of the news. I-15 through Utah is a major thoroughway for drugs. And so because of those stops and because of those things, a lot of drugs don't get to the streets of Utah, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's definitely true. We get anywhere from small user amounts like Jessica went to pick up later after she got out of jail. And then we get more massive amounts. We have our undercover guys who pick up, 2, 4, 15, 20 pounds of methamphetamine at a time. Recently, there's been a little bit more of a surge in heroin, and they're picking up pounds and pounds of heroin, which is really unusual. And that, you get a pound of heroin, that's enough to kill a lot of people.
And a lot of that, we had a DEA agent on a town hall I did a while back, and a lot of that's laced with fentanyl, and that's very deadly. And so a lot of people are, can no longer get their pills anymore, and so the natural progression is to go to heroin. And then, it's Russian roulette with drugs. You just don't know if that next one's going to be your last one.
It's dangerous, yeah.
I want to get back to Jessica real quick, because Hatchie picked up the heroin, and you pulled her over and landed a felony. I think for a lot of the young listeners or family members at home, a felony is a bad thing to catch. It can affect your life for the rest of your life. We've had a lot of people on here who have seemed to succeed even though having that, but it really does put you behind the eight ball.
It does. It can make a lot of things more difficult. Simple things like you lose the right to vote. You lose the right to possess a firearm, certain kinds of other dangerous weapons, swords and knives and things like that. But it's problematic in
that
way.
What about a passport? Can you travel internationally if you have a felony?
I think there are some restrictions on that. I think those restrictions are more in the countries that will let you in, not in the ability to get one here. But some will block you from coming. Where you can go.
Because of my DUI, I can't go to Canada.
Right.
What's that about?
I don't know, hoser.
But not only that, because I had my real estate license at one time, felonies can really help hurt you from renting an apartment, finding places to live, getting the job that you wanted. A felony can really keep you from doing a lot of things. And so you need to be cognizant of that when you're out there and you're young and you think you're invincible and, you can't be touched. A felony can really slow you down.
Yeah, we should choose to not use drugs for the right reasons, and I wouldn't say that not using drugs because you don't want a felony that's going to mess up renting an apartment or getting a job or things like that. But if that's what it takes to keep you from using, great. I'm all for that while you're looking for the other more positive motivations for not doing it. But that is something that happens down the road that you don't even think about immediately when you go to use.
Well, I think Dr. Matt in the beginning of the podcast said we want to be preventative, and that's really what we should talk to the youth about is, you think that this is going to be fun, but if this happens, this could really change your life for the rest of your life. And so, because we've had people sit down there where you are, Sergeant Cannon, talking about racking up felony after felony after felony because they were already mired in the system. So what's one more felony going to do? Mm-hmm. I think we had the lady on and she had 21 felonies.
I think that's our record, yeah.
21 felonies on one person.
That's a lot.
And now she's out. She's doing wonderful and doing amazing things.
It makes you question eventually, what are these felonies all about? Why are they not changing a person's behavior? A behaviorist or a behavioral psychologist will tell you that when we use the term punishment, it only gets to be a punishment if it reduces negative behavior. And so at some point, a person is getting punished over and over again, but it's not reducing their behavior. So we have to look at other means, like why aren't these felonies stopping this person from doing these things? And it may be then back to kind of the theme of this show, maybe we need to focus on recovery. And I'm glad that there are so many, there are starting to become more and more programs out there, by the state, even federal programs that help people reduce felonies and get sober, so that that's the real core issue. But
I think people say you shouldn't be putting addicts in jail. You shouldn't be putting drug users in jail. And I understand what they're saying, and I agree that treatment should be, needs to be the first option. But as I'm sure you both know, those you lead the horse to water, and if that horse chooses not to drink, they're going to continue to use. Yeah. And at some point, the behaviors outside of using that people engage in, stealing from their family, Jessica did that, burglarizing homes, robberies, things like that. Society at some point has to be protected from them until they make the choice to start getting clean. They get their support system in place and they make the choice to move forward and not do
it
anymore.
I think it's a complicated issue because, you know, arguably many people who are addicted wouldn't be doing any of those illegal behaviors if they weren't addicted. So it's kind of, you know, chicken or the egg sort of thing. I've talked to, I can think of a few different people, but one guy in particular who had lost his college scholarship. He was a D1 athlete. Mm. He'd lost all of that. He was, you know, struggling with addiction and came in my office one day, broke down in tears. Great big guy, just bawling in my office, finally got it together. And I was really worried because he'd never acted like this before. And it was because he had broken into someone's home and stolen things. And he was so ashamed of himself that he would go to those lengths to feed his addiction. And of course, you know, I worked with some other doctors and we got him into an appropriate program. But, you know, it's a questionable, of course, if a person's breaking the law, if they're assaulting someone, if they're stealing property, if, you know, those sorts of things can't be tolerated. At the same time, if we can get a person into a healthy program and they become healthy, then a lot of these people, what's the theme of this show? Give back. People are given back like crazy once they get, you know, clean and sober. So it's, should we be accountable for our behavior? Sure.
100%.
But at the same time, what's causing that behavior? Is it getting attention? And I would say if you go back 10, 15, 20 years, there were fewer opportunities to get people into programs than there are now. I think society's recognizing that these programs, even like the one you went through, Casey.
The 24/7.
Yeah, that allowed you to have a vehicle and to work. And because you were ready, like the sergeant said, you were ready to use that program to your advantage, it worked for you. And so it does come down to personal, you know, the whole behavior change model. Are we just contemplating or are we ready for action? And that does happen on somewhat of an individual basis.
Here's how I see it. When it comes to addiction and recovery, the majority of the world looks at both those problems as a black and white problem. And the reality is in both of those worlds, it's 50 shades of gray, if you'll let me. Because, you know, recovery is different for everybody. It's not a one size fits all. Because what makes me an addict is not going to makes him an addict, and the problems I'm dealing are not. There's a lot of similarities, but it's not a one size fits all. And you go 30, 40 years ago with law enforcement, the answer was lock them up, And now we're here.
I will defend law enforcement for a second and say, well, that their job's to enforce the law.
Yeah.
Their job isn't to provide treatment. I think that we're evolving in how law enforcement, and I'd love to hear the sergeant's take on this. But here in Salt Lake County, for example, we have police officers that are becoming certified in mental health intervention. So understanding that because they're often and thankfully the first people on the scene with somebody who has a mental health problem or a substance abuse problem, realizing that maybe their job description can start to include understanding that. But in the past, that wasn't part of the job description, and I hope it continues to become that.
It really is becoming that. In fact, as we speak right now, my boss, Lieutenant Jeff Jones, is teaching crisis intervention training right now. This week, Sheriff Smith and many other heads of law enforcement agencies are wanting all of their people to get through that, and we're working that way, but it's a 40-hour program and it's hard, but we're getting as many as we can. It's really interesting. One of the things they teach you is to in this training is to talk to people as though it's a comfortable thing to discuss. I remember I had a guy pull over one night, 1 or 2 in the morning in American Fork, and I don't remember what I stopped him for, but I could tell there were some mental health challenges on board, some kind of a diagnosis. And so I just asked him, say, so what's your diagnosis? And the weight just lifted off his shoulders. I think he had been afraid of what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. You could just see the difference. And he turned in his seat and looked at me. And we talked for like 20 minutes about his diagnosis because I knew there was something going on there. And more officers are learning how to do that. And it makes the issue more comfortable because so many people with just, I hate to use the word, regular mental health issues, you know, depression or whatever, that don't have substance abuse also have the substance abuse problems as well.
Right.
Either the mental health challenges because of the substance abuse, or they have mental health challenges
and they're self-medicating.
They self-medicate. And so I kind of look at, for those who won't or can't get themselves to get help themselves, I've considered what I do as one of the first steps in substance abuse treatment. If they can't make the decision on their own, I put them in front of a judge to give them opportunities. And I have had a lot of calls over the years from prosecutors saying, hey, we've got this case you sent to us, and this is what we're thinking about doing as far as a plea. You know, they get into a program, or they don't do jail, or they go to drug court or whatever. I am all for that. And one of the things I like about having them still in the court system is that it holds a little weight over their head. Mm-hmm. And for some people, the fear of that weight coming down on them if they don't do what they're supposed to keeps them doing what they're supposed to until they can do it on their own or because they want to. And I've never looked at this as a game or a competition for numbers. It's about, you know, helping people. I wish I'd have known the night that I stopped Jessica that she had a problem and I could have talked to her about it. But, you know, she got it. She did it on her own. But, you know, it's about helping people and getting to the point where they want that help and will accept it, you know.
You know, we've had a lot of people who sit down and done this podcast, and they'd been to multiple rehabs, multiple inpatient recoveries, a lot of inpatient recoveries, and never worked. And then we've had them sitting there and goes, it wasn't until I was in jail that it got me clean.
Yeah, I haven't, like you said, that weight over them, it's a sobering type of experience, I assume, to sit in jail and have your freedom at that moment at least taken away from you, and you sit there and probably the smartest folks, you know, turn inward and think, what did I do to get myself in this situation, and that might start them down that road of accepting and wanting help. And so I think there's a lot of benefit to the modern perspective in law enforcement of being able to pull a person over and have some crisis intervention training and be able to talk to them about a diagnosis and to educate our law enforcement on what is mental health, like what's a mental health problem. And the reality is, and I we won't do this today, but we could go around this room, myself included, and you could find family histories of mental health problems, including substance abuse, for everybody in here. Mm-hmm. That is just part of the human condition. But in the past, the stigma has been so high that we don't talk about it, and we feel ashamed of it. We're afraid of it.
Because according to Facebook, we're all living our best lives, and everything's just upbeat and hunky-dory.
Yeah, that's yeah. true.
I mean, it really is. I mean, but that's the stigma.
Well, there's a lot of social media problems.
Me and Sergeant Cannon, we're talking about it in the elevator up, that, you know, the stigma is such that none of us want to talk until something bad happens to us. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, we're inducted into a fraternity we didn't want to be a part of, but now we've got these friends that are going through stuff that we've been going through. But before that, nobody's talking about it. Nobody's doing, I mean, it's acting like it doesn't exist.
Right.
Everyone's like, well, that happened to them? Mm-hmm. And you know dang well you've got it happen in your own family. But you're talking about other people like they've got a problem because nobody wants to admit that it's in our family. And I think you're 100% right. You know, if you get a room of 100 people and you say, hey, raise your hand if anyone in your family is mental health, you know.
Oh, everybody should raise their hand because it's just part of the life that human beings lead. And the solution, or the preventative sort of solution, is to start with education. And education starts at home with, are we talking about it in our families? And so, you know, for when the police officer pulls you over, if he or she knows, hey, I may relate to some of the things that this person's struggling with today, and I may need to provide a ticket or a citation, or I mean, may need to take someone in. But if you just have that empathy and understanding about what could be happening with that person, you may be pulling them over on the worst day of their life, right?
And
having that empathy backed up, of course, with enforcement of the law, I think is a wonderful combination. I've seen great things. A couple of years ago at our clinic downtown, we had some of the folks from the Salt Lake Police Department come in and talk about their training, just to educate us, the doctors, about what they were doing so that we could feel like we're sort of on the same team. And I thought that was fantastic.
You know, you want to talk about our first responders, and that's our police officers, our EMTs, our doctors, emergency rooms. You know, and you said to see you might be seeing somebody on their worst day.
Yeah.
Imagine your day is seeing everybody on their worst day.
Oh, sure.
I mean, that's a lot for you guys to carry around day in and day out. And I've had multiple people from multiple agencies reach out to me and want help because the stigma with them is that they're afraid to tell anybody. And they're looking for help. And so everybody's looking for help. And I'm so grateful for you to stop by and share your story. We're going to take a break here, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about how addiction affected your family. You're listening to Project Recovery right here on KSL. Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. Our guest today is Sergeant Spencer Cannon. You've been in law enforcement for how many years?
A little over 30 years.
So you've seen a lot.
Yeah.
And you've had addiction touch close to home.
Yes, I have.
I remember Jessica saying that there was times that you were patrolling the streets and you would see your kids out there doing some stuff. And, you know, you're a law enforcement and you're a father. How does one deal with that?
Yeah, it's a difficult balance. I remember the first time that I found my son. I was at home, was falling asleep on the couch. My oldest son got home and he says, "Dad, what's Kevin doing sleeping in the car down the street?" Well, he wasn't living at home with us. He'd moved out the day he turned 18, his choice. And I thought, there's something's up here. So I go down to the car and he's drunk as a skunk and he's high as a kite. And he's got he was 18. He's got three juveniles in the car with him, and he was providing alcohol and weed to them. I knew he'd been using, but I hadn't caught him red-handed yet, so this was the first time, and the struggle inside was so real in what do I do. I called my wife, who was at work, and I told her where I was, and we were on the phone, and she was crying, and I was crying, and I remember the light came on and said, "I know what I have to do because I can't fix it. I need to try the way I've been trying it for so many others for so many years." And I called dispatch and I said, "Send an American Fork officer and stay on the line with me because I don't want to kill my son." And I was physically shaking. I was so mad. And they came and they said, "What do you want us to do?" And I said, "Just pretend you don't know me and do whatever you would do with any other drunk that you find on the side of the road." And he got arrested. And he didn't like it. He went on doing that for three more years, got arrested a couple more times, but he went over 13 years clean in March. And
I can't imagine.
You know, his NA community, we owe them a debt of gratitude because they did for him what we couldn't. You know, all we could do is love him, and it was his NA friends who are our friends and really family in so many ways. That got him where he is today because we couldn't.
You know, Sergeant Spencer, Cannon, we say in this, the opposite of addiction isn't abstinence. The opposite of addiction is connection. And it sounds like your son found that connection with the mm-hmm. NA community.
He did.
It's somebody that he could relate to, somebody he could empathize with, somebody he could sympathize with, somebody who gets what he's going through.
In a way that we don't. You know, I've dealt with addiction and alcoholism my entire career. I've seen it in other people. I've seen the impact it has on them. I've seen family members who are impacted by the choices that their family member is making. But I don't understand it the way a recovering addict does. And there's something – I can tell them everything I've seen and the impact it has and the legal impact it's going to have on their life long term. But when they sit down and talk to somebody who has been there, mm-hmm. when you talk to somebody, Casey, who – just got their DUI and they aren't yet where you are now, they will listen to you long before they'll listen to me because you get it. You know it. I don't. As much as I love my son and as much as I love his friends, I've never been where they are. And to have somebody like that, the recovery community is nothing short of angels on earth. I mean, they really are for what they do for those who want to get recovery. And they're not looking for perfection. They do not judge you. It's like mindfulness. It's being present without judgment. That's what the recovery community is like. You will not find a less judgmental group of people than those who are in recovery.
And I think that's part of the cement that makes that connection so strong. A person who hasn't had the experience but knows how to be empathetic can make a connection with a person who's struggling. But without that, and sometimes a person can project no judgment, but it's what's perceived by the person. And if that person knows that you've been where they've been, then there's an automatic understanding of no judgment. And even if you're trying as a person to be non-judgmental, and this is something that I think therapists struggle with, and I'm sure law enforcement struggles with, is the receiver may still perceive judgment, even if it's not necessarily there. But one of the magical things about the folks that work in substance abuse counseling is generally they've been there,
mm-hmm.
and the person receiving the help knows it. And that makes a special kind of connection where judgment really isn't on the table at all. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about the work that people do in that community.
I've said it so many times on this podcast. When I was married, my ex-wife goes, "Why can't you just quit? Just quit." And she would say it so matter of fact, like it was like, "Well, just don't do it." And right. I'll be like,
and to her credit, I mean that's her experience. Well, her type of person, but she's never experienced that, and mm-hmm. she doesn't know. You know, she didn't have any reason to think otherwise. I mean, we just do a lot of stuff. You just get up and go to work, or you just take the dog out. Why can't you just stop drinking? And it sounds silly, but I don't fault her for that.
No, and I don't fault her at all either.
I know you don't. I think you have a lot of empathy for her, but it's a great example of had she had experience with alcoholism, either in her family or her own life, she would have known that it's not that easy.
And that's what this podcast is about, is giving everybody an education. And I think that's what society needs, is an education on addiction and recovery, and let people know that it's not the shameful thing. I've done shameful things, but I'm not shameful. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, I've done things that I've never thought I would do, and I've hurt people, and I didn't mean to, but I know that's not who I am, and I'm sorry that I did those, but mm-hmm. I can't live in that shame.
But we don't have to keep beating you with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, once you get through it. I got to share one quick experience. I arrested a gal. It was around New Year's Eve 6 or 7 years ago, and she had marijuana. She was drunk. She had a firearm in the car with her, which you can't do when you're an unlawful user of a controlled substance. And took her to jail. She did not like me. She wouldn't cooperate with me. I have a daughter who was in and out of treatment for eating disorders at the time. And she told me one day, I said, "Dad, I think I might know somebody that you arrested once." Well, we go there for a family day, and this is at Center for Change in Orem.
We've had her on the show.
Yes.
Ms. Hawkins, yeah.
Nicole Hawkins. Fantastic what they do there at Center for Change. Well, I walk into the basement of Center for Change, and there's this woman that I arrested. And I think she wasn't sure how to react, but I walked up and I just gave her a hug and told her how proud I was of her for where she was. I mean, you're not here because you're a failure. You're here because you want to succeed.
And you're a fighter.
Exactly. And I have a small handful of people that I've arrested that I'm Facebook friends with and that I stay in contact with and who have my personal cell phone number. And she's one of them. And every now and then I'll text her and say, "Hey, how's life treating you?" And it is so rewarding to see those who can have success. And we see it on the other end of the spectrum occasionally too. But, these people, they aren't failures because they use. Every one of them, without exception, will tell you that I don't like the life I'm living or the way I'm living my life. They want to change. They just don't know how to do it, and they can't bring themselves to do it.
You don't know how many people reach out to me on Facebook, and they're like, "Hey, can you talk to my wife? Can you talk to my husband?" Mm. They're heavy in their addiction, and I don't get it. They're having all the fun, and I'm paying all the price. And I go, "You got to stop right there," because I can tell you right now, if you've got somebody in your life that's heavy into addiction, they're not having fun.
No.
It's all
fun
about—
Fun stopped a long time
fun
ago.
Fun stopped. This is just survival. They just want to get to an even base to where they can function and be somewhat normal, if you will. It's not fun. And it goes back to what we talked about at the beginning of the podcast. They're coping. I remember when I sat down in recovery, and my therapist goes, "So you're an alcoholic?" And I go, "Yep." And he goes, "Well, alcohol's not your problem." And I go, "What? I'm pretty sure it is. I'm here in rehab. I'm pretty sure alcohol is my problem."
It's in the name, alcohol.
Yeah, and he goes, "Well, alcohol is not your problem. Your problems are your problems, and alcohol is your solution. And that's what you're using to help your problems."
That's insightful.
He goes, "But don't get it wrong. Alcohol is now a problem for you, but it's not your problem, your root problem. And that's what we need to do, is strip
back
in the layers.
Back to coping skills, right?
And get down to what your problems are." Mm-hmm. And I think that's, really kind of what a lot of addicts are going through is that's how they cope. That's how they survive. That's how they numb. That's how they escape. And so until we can sit down and find out what's really going on, which is hard for people to talk about because it has to do with trauma, has to talk with sexual abuse, has to talk about some things that are not very fun to talk about.
Mental health disorders, yeah.
That it's just easier to pick up a bottle.
So, Sergeant Cannon, I want to ask, so how many kids do you have?
I have five kids, two boys and three girls.
Two boys and three girls. And so far we've learned that you've had one son who struggled with alcoholism and maybe others.
Drug addiction,
okay. And then a daughter with eating disorders.
And she struggled also with drug addiction and alcohol abuse.
Which, again, you know, those mental health issues and substance abuse issues often go hand in hand, of course, because nothing feels worse than having an untreated mental health issue. So we understand people, of course, would turn to drugs and alcohol to sort of numb that out. And that then we double our problems. How about the other kids? So you have three other kids. Have you had other kids who've struggled as well?
Normal, I would call. I don't know if there's any
typical,
normal, but typical kind of life challenges. You know,
okay.
I've got a son who went through divorce. He's since remarried, and I've got the others seem to be handling their normal life day-to-day challenges pretty well. But
and typical life challenges, we won't
slight
those. Those can be big too,
yeah,
as well. But luckily, they haven't struggled with addiction as well. Mm-hmm. How is your son doing now, and how is your daughter doing at this time?
My daughter, she's clean from drugs. She still thinks that she can use alcohol, and for the last couple of years, it has not been too problematic other than costing an arm and a leg to engage in that. But she's doing pretty well on the eating disorder. She regularly goes to see her therapist and her dietitian.
Good for her.
Which I heard Nicole Hawkins talk about in that podcast when you had her on. Critical thing for her to do, but she's doing pretty well. My son, who has been 13 years clean now, he works is a barber at a local barbershop here in Salt Lake. Has a great life. And, you know, when he wasn't going the course that we, as his parents, wanted him to, we just said, Kevin, if you will just be a decent, productive member of society, we will be happy for what you're doing. And he's doing that. And we have to fall up on our side of that and be happy for him. And we genuinely are. And we love him. We love the community that he is. We had a bunch of his friends and their motorcycles come down to our little quiet home there in Birdseye last summer. And the noise that those bikes made was music to my ears, yeah, because it spoke recovery, because all of them are recovering addicts.
Oh,
and
they
love
great
and support each other, and they go for rides. They just went to an NA convention someplace, I think maybe down in St. George, and it's what they do. They keep each other strong when one's weak. They lost a friend too.
Yeah.
My son's roommate had a relapse, and he lost the fight. And they all mourned over that because they all knew him. But boy, they're successful now, and they're good examples of what successful, productive members of society should do.
That's fantastic.
Let me ask you, why would you share your story with the general public in being what you are and who you are? You know what I mean? And I mean, I wonder if there's a stigma that carries into the police officers.
You know, I don't really care what people think. That wasn't always the case. There was a time when we tried to keep it within. But with our son, I mean, we got to the point where we told him, you're not welcome in our home. If you come to our house, you knock on the door like any stranger does, and if we're not here, you leave. And that was so hard to do. He went up to Seattle, and we thought, Seattle of all places where you can get anything you want. And that's where he found recovery. But I want people to know. In my work, I tell people, I'll look them in the eye and say, you know, when you can see the despair on their face because this is new to them. And I can tell them, I know what you're going through, not just because I've seen it through work, but because my son did the same thing to us, or we responded the same way. And you can get through it, you know, and don't try to fix it all at once, but just like they say in NA, just for today, one day at a time. And if I can help somebody even just a little bit to see that little light or feel that glimmer of hope that, okay, it's a long road, but we're going to get through it. You know, when I get a call from one of my coworkers and he says, hey, we did these are our narcotics detectives, and so we just did a warrant on a house and we got all these kids sitting here in handcuffs in the living room, and we get a knock on the door, it's your son and he's got dope in his pockets. What do you want us to do? I said, pretend you don't know me. because he's not learning from me. That was the third time he got arrested. So I'm glad to share it with anybody, and I don't care what they know the warts, because that's if people think I shouldn't do that, I don't really care.
That is, I'm feeling some chills right now just thinking right? from another parent's perspective how powerful your connection with another parent could be, because I don't know, like, if I had the ability, what would I do? If I had the ability to say, just bring them back home, boy, that would be my temptation. Mm-hmm. So to be able to have, because we've had parents on the show before who talk about they need support, they need help. Mm-hmm. How do you stand strong? What's the right thing to do? You know,
I believe I know what's the right thing to do, and I'll probably take great flack for saying this, but not all cops do it that way, and it's wrong.
Well, I'm sitting here thinking if I had the power to have my son brought home instead of sent to jail, what would I do? And I think that it would take a real strong person to be able to let your child taste the natural consequences of their behavior. And it sounds to me like you know, from that first arrest, prior to that, you were suspicious that he was struggling. You said he moved out of his own choice at 18. So that just tells me, the therapist, that there had been some conflict going on there, and maybe he was a strong-willed sort of kid. Mm-hmm. And I think you kind of knew he needed to strike out and find his own path. But that still must have been hard as a parent to let the natural consequences take over.
It was. I mean, we were half a block from home. I could have walked him home and laid him on the floor and said, sleep it off, you know, but it wasn't going to fix the problem. Wasn't going to even get close to getting him on the path to helping him get into recovery.
So I hope my kids are listening, because if they ever are in that situation, I'm just going to call you and I'm going to let you make the decision for me. So listen up, kids.
So, but I want to go back to 15 minutes ago when you said you would talk to an addict and they wouldn't relate to you because you don't know what they've been through. Now you're telling your story, and I think parents would love to hear your story. And I think that's why this episode's going to be so powerful, because they're going to say, oh, he knows what we've gone through and we've done this. And so you're just touching it on the other side, and recovery takes up, it's both sides of the coin to make it work.
Casey, if you ever get one of those calls from one of those parents and they need to talk to somebody who turned their own kids in, give them my phone number and have them call me. You have my permission.
It's amazing. I mean,
any time, day or night. We've had parents come to us who are struggling, and I've seen parents who handle it in a way that I think isn't the most healthy or the most productive. Certainly, we made mistakes along the way, but if I can help somebody, man, I'll wake up at 3 a.m. and go help them if I can.
I'm wondering if people are at home listening to this and they have kids or somebody who's going through an active addiction. Is the police department okay with us calling them going, hey, look, I've got this situation and I don't know what to do. And I'm not saying come pick up my kid, but I just need somebody to talk it through with. I mean, is that something that you guys would be willing to do?
Yeah. You know, and there are certain circumstances where we would have to do something. But let's say the kid came home and he's drunk. They may issue a citation, but, you know, there are situations where that doesn't happen, too. And we will we've had parents call and say, I worry that there's drugs in my kid's room.
Bring the dog.
Bring the dog over. And we do. And usually we'll say we may have to take some legal action on it. But that's just from the approach of saying we want to get them to a position where they've got some force behind them, at least maybe motivating them if nothing else is working right now.
We call it leverage.
Leverage. There you go.
A little leverage and say, hey, you know, this is what's going on. And because if we don't stop it now, who knows when we are going to stop it or how it ends. Mm-hmm. So I think it goes back to what we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, is being preventative. And that's what we want to do. We'd rather keep people from going down to hit the rock bottom rather than helping them climb out. But we got to help both sides. So I want to say thank you for stopping by. I mean, I think...
Whoa. Pump the brakes.
Okay.
We still haven't heard how he found it, how he re-met our previous guest.
Jessica Butterfield.
Jessica Butterfield. So I just want the listeners, from your perspective, was that a surprise to you that she showed up again in your life, and how did it happen?
It was. Neither one of us recognized each other right away. It was
You said there was a house being built next door to you.
Well, the there's three houses in a row. Hers is right next door to mine, and it was already built. Ours had actually been built before hers was, but we bought it from the previous owners. And so both houses were there. We move in. We think, oh, here's a nice family. We got young couples on both sides of us. Each of them have three young kids, and we love kids. And it just seemed like a really great situation. I was sitting in church one day with Jessica's husband, Trevor, and he leaned over and says, yeah, my wife says you were her arresting officer. And I'm thinking, the first thought is, I hope I was nice. You know, I hope I was decent to her. But when
and
I
now
learned
we're
that,
moving.
And it was about that time that she was starting her podcast, which she called Mountain Mama Podcast now, which has been rebranded to the Hope Addiction?
Yeah.
Yeah. But what it does for me to see where she is now, it's, I can almost not even think of words for the joy that it brings me to see what's in her life and what would be missing from the lives of her husband and her children had she not been able to find recovery. Her husband is an incredible man. She didn't share with you, but and I'm going to take the liberty to share this. They were dating, and she hadn't told him yet that she was a recovering heroin addict. They are on a date one night, and Trevor's just – something's up. She's not acting normal. They get home. They sit on his her front porch. She's going to tell him, but she doesn't. He drives away. He gets a block away, and she calls him and says, come back. We need to talk. And he comes back. They sit there talking, and she says, I'm a recovering heroin addict. And she'd been clean about a year at that point. And he was so relieved because he thought she was going to break up with her.
Yeah, I was going to say, you don't want to get that call. We need to talk.
And he says, is that it? And that was Trevor's reaction. That's the kind of guy Trevor is.
That's
you know,
pretty great.
And there's so much going on there, but to see the success she has in recovery, what she's doing with that now and sharing that with others, and the beautiful little family that she has and her kids that come over with their dirty faces and play in my backyard and – you know, that's what life should be for everybody, and she managed to get herself there.
Yeah, she's living a good life now, and that's great. And part of it goes back to, again, a connection, which we talk about so much, and she was able to connect with what sounds like a really great, understanding husband, and together they've built this wonderful life. But
and my life is fuller because she's in it again.
That's nice.
It really is.
And I think that just puts an exclamation point on recovery is possible. I mean, it really is. If you would have went back and talked to Jessica 10 years ago while she's stealing and running for heroin in Salt Lake, would she be living the life that she's got now? And she would have probably said, there's no way. There's no way I'm going to get that fulfillment of life. And here she is. And it's amazing. And out of ashes comes a phoenix. And it is amazing when recovery does work. And it can work if you'll let it work. And you got to want it.
She definitely brought herself out of the ashes. Yeah.
Well, thank you for stopping by. Are we good to close, Dr. Matt?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I appreciate you stopping by and giving me your number. And if people need help, I will definitely pass it along. But we'd love to have you back. And thank you for your years of service and everything you're doing to protect and serve. It really is amazing. And it was great to sit down and chat with you. Dr. Matt?
Yeah, I just echo that. Thank you so much. And I appreciate you coming on and being a voice of, I'm calling it, I don't know if anyone else calls it, kind of the modern era of law enforcement, which is, you know, a more educated on these subjects type of officer that a person can, kind of like in Mayberry, you can turn to the sheriff and ask a question and feel like he's your friend and he understands you. And I love that story you told about having that 20-minute conversation with the person about his diagnosis. He felt understood instead of like a criminal. He felt like, here's somebody who might be able to help me or at least understands me. And that's a beautiful story. So thank you so much
for
coming on.
We're making, as a profession in law enforcement, we have a long ways to go, but we're making, I think, good progress in that.
Absolutely.
Arena.
We appreciate it. Thank you for stopping by. Project Recovery is brought to you by KnowYourScript.org. Don't forget, Project Recovery is a KSL podcast.
The contents of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.